The NFL playoffs are here, and DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL, is kicking things off with a huge offer. Counting down to Super Bowl 56, new customers can get 56-1 odds on any wildcard team to win their game. Bet just $5 and win $280 in free bets if your team is victorious. If Sportsbook isn't available in your state yet, and you still have something to play for this wildcard weekend. Everyone can play for huge cash prizes with DraftKings Daily Fantasy Football Contest. DraftKings is giving all new customers a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes with their first deposit. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use promo code THPN and get 56-1 odds on any NFL team. Bet just $5 and win $280 in free bets if your team wins. That's promo code THPN this wild card weekend at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Must be 21 years or older, New Jersey, Indiana, Pennsylvania only. New customers only. Minimum $5 deposit and $1 wager required. One per customer. Restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Gambling problems? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Want to go, pretty boy?
Two minutes by yourself, and you feel shame, you know, and then you get free.
The only thing better than a glass of beer is tea with Miss McGill.
And welcome to the Fourth Line Voice Podcast. My name is Darren. Thank you very much for tuning in. Episode 174 of The Big Show, some enforcer-based podcasting, the international edition. Because I'm telling you, folks, we are going international. From the Italian Hockey Federation basement, I got Jay on the line. Jay, what's happening? How are you today?
Well, I have to be honest, I'm a little confused because I thought I dialed up the number over to Madison Square Garden. I wanted to talk to Joe Lucido, but apparently we have to go with a 306.
Exactly. Well, no, yeah, this is the hold music at MSG. when they put you on hold, you get dispatched over here to the Mud Show in Saskatchewan. Yeah, Lucido. Hey, don't take this personally. Lucido doesn't have time for you. He doesn't have time for me. He doesn't talk to low-level people like us.
I know, but I still love my Joe's balls.
Exactly. You know, between the Yule log and Joe's balls, number one Wang, man, I'm telling you. Yeah.
All right. But hey, really, it's great to be back here. And before we start chatting, I just wanted to say thanks to you and Alec and Joe for all the great job you guys have done for all of us. And, you know, now that we all live during this fucking COVID life, it means a lot for me to have all these shows coming up on my Spotify list all the time. And also, I want to say thank you to a few bands who have, you know, released some great albums last year and, you know, really kept me going. So thank you, Plisken. Thank you, Severi, Apapat, Voyenacht, Akaleko Urdanok, Orreaga 778, and Cuero. And thanks to the record labels Tough Ain't Enough Records and Mendeku Discog. And now back to the studio.
Well, fuck, like I said, this is like Dingo and the Baby over here. Here we go. It's the morning drive show.
Yeah, and I really need to get a swing of this English language again, so I'll give it my best shot, buddy.
Well, how many languages can you speak?
I'd say six, you know, and then I can understand and, you know, get by speaking three more additional languages, but that's all thanks to hockey. You know, when you move around so much and you always go to new countries and new cultures, it's not only the respectful thing to learn a new language, but it's basically one of the key factors if you want to succeed, because there's too many people maybe sometimes who think that everybody everywhere speaks English, but no, that's not how the world goes.
Well, assimilation into a new... Yeah. We are going to discuss that.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to discuss that topic with fighters and assimilating into North American hockey and culture. We'll do all that. Look at, I mean, it's like I'm talking to the United Nations here. Look at six languages and stuff. I barely got out of grade eight French, and you're going six languages. That's impressive, man.
But that still doesn't mean that I am a civilized person.
Oh, I know that, you know. You could really articulate while you're cavemanning it up, but you could articulate yourself very well. Well, there you go.
Yeah, but hey, since we are going to speak about European fighters today, yes. I know that you have your two favorites. You have Tino Sara and you have Ulf Samuelsson. I'm sorry, but those guys, I will not have any kind of, you know, discussion about. But hey, people, please go on YouTube and search for John Searson. There's some incredible footage. Like, that guy was a monster. Like, he was just killing guys, you know, left, right, and center. It's incredible to watch.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's serious. That's my Nottingham, the fourth line voice Nottingham offices. But I mean, I haven't really told him yet. There might be some changes in his department. We'll see.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we had a draw. We had a draw and his name came up. Yeah. So we'll see. Okay. You know.
Yeah.
But, like I said, I guess normally in this part of the show is when I'm doing the, when I said I'm a member of the Hockey Podcast Network, there's over 50 shows in the network. All the NHL teams are represented, so you folks should check that out. And then, of course, then I start talking about part-time Ole down there in Florida, Mud Show. Oh, yeah. The Five for Fighting podcast. Oh, he's on the network now. He's a big deal.
He's such a stalker these days, too, eh?
Oh, I know. Actually, you know what? He's apparently he has today off. He goes, "Oh, I have tomorrow off." I said, "Well, I think it would probably be easier for everybody if you told us what days you had on." You know, I mean, wow. I mean, that guy's whole life's a holiday, gallivanting around there. You know, down there.
The only thing he is fucking worried about is the code.
Yeah, well, I know. The code and where you can find Busch Light Apple. Those are his two things in life that he worries about.
Alec Coden Salen, ladies and gentlemen. Alec Coden Salen.
That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, and then of course, Broadway Joe, give it a Lizito. Oh, they're the world famous MSG out in New York. Have you ever been to New York?
Only very briefly at the JFK, and then I went to see a Rangers game once. I'm so sorry, Joe. Very sorry.
You've been to MSG. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, sorry.
I shouldn't say that meant going to a Ranger. I'd probably rather go see the fucking Holiday on Ice than a Ranger game. But I'd love to see MSG, for
sure.
But
I spent over a week in the state of New York in this quaint little city called Syracuse. This was back in 1999 or 2000. And the first game on that trip I saw was between the Crunch and the Philly Phantoms. And they were stacked that year. There was Francis Lessard, Steve McLaren, Eric Bertrand, Ryan Bast. Maybe Fridge was there as well. Maybe Bouleris was there as well. But it was pretty damn incredible to watch those rosters. And then the Albany team, they had Sasha Lakovic there, and Springfield had, I think they had, you know, Kevin Sawyer, Dan Fott. Oh, great games.
Oh, yes. The joys of late 90s AHL. Yeah. What a time. But
thank God the game today is so much faster and more skilled. So I'm very happy for this development.
Yeah, I've been told numerous times it's better now, bro.
Oh, yeah, bro.
Yeah. So, but you know what? You and I, we're going to go back in the past because we don't get it. So we may as well stay back in the past. And we're going to talk about a few things here. Well, first things first, in all seriousness, folks, I've had Jay on the show before, and we kind of, in that episode, we, you know, basically your journey through hockey and the, you know, the Ice Warriors tournament and all that. And we talked about all that in your first show. But, and I know we also talked about you wrote a book with Sammy Helenius about his story. We talked briefly about that. But once again, for the new, we got new listeners here. Let's talk about that again. When did that book come out, and what, give us some background on Sammy and his story, and maybe a few stories about him.
Yeah, sure. The book came out in 2004, and that was the year or the season when Sammy had finally decided, you know, to return, you know, back to Finland. And yeah, the funny thing is with Sammy, he was 6'5 or 6'6, and he got signed by Calgary, a 3 or 4 year contract, and he enters the American League as a 20-year-old with no prior fighting experience whatsoever. And when you are 6'5 or 6'6, you're gonna attract some attention, you know, with that size alone. And it was fairly tough for Sammy those first couple of years. Like he says in his book, like he found all the possible ways how to lose a fight because he had zero experience and he had to fight guys who had been doing this job for anything, you know, between 5 to 10 years already. And, you know, he went against guys like Turner Stevenson, Darcy Simon, Bill Armstrong, Ken Blanchard, Kevin Sawyer, Mike Ware, Dennis Maxwell, Chumba Duke, Joe Lothario. But in the end, he learned, you know, the secrets of the trade, and he played for Calgary, Tampa, Dallas, and Colorado. And you know, it's pretty neat to think that this was around the time when the team started to carry like only one like true number one heavyweight, and then you had like these top stay at home D's and these power forwards. So for a few years there, in I think it was a 30 team league at the time. So Sammy was, in his own way, you know, one of the top players, you know, playing that role. Yeah, sure, he didn't beat up guys like, you know, Short LaRocque or, you know, Brashear. But he did something right, and you know, just to consider that he goes to the Wild American League as a 20-year-old with no prior fighting experience, and he just has to learn the secrets of the trade against some very dangerous professionals. That takes a lot of, you know, character and a lot of balls.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting. Like I said, we'll go in on this topic a little more as we go on here, and you know, especially coming with. Like on this side of the microphone, of course, with the North American view on things, right? And I think probably a lot of listeners, I'm including myself in this, of course, you get the whole, you know, you grew up with the, I mean, for lack of a better term, but like the Don Cherry stereotype, right? Oh, the soft Euro, right? Yeah. And you get that. And I think, and it's very, and Cherry wasn't the only guy, right? That was sort of, well, and at the same time, it was, I mean, it was sort of correct in the fact that it was just it was just a different style of hockey played in Finland and overseas, and it still is, and it's just the way the mindset of the game is towards the game is just different on each continent, right? So I mean, that's just natural. That's not saying anything racial or anything. That's just the way it is. I mean, hockey's just viewed differently, or the mindset around the game is just different. So of course, you have this idea that all these guys are soft, right? Which isn't true at all when you see it. And like you said, to be 20 years old to come over from Finland in a non-fighting hockey to come over and immediately, like you said, 69 games, 200 minutes and penalties in the American League in mid-90s when like every team had 3 and 4 guys, like, yeah, that is huge fucking balls to come over and do that. And I think, and we're all, I'm including myself in this, and we're all guilty of it. I think, that doesn't get viewed. We don't look at it that way, right? Like when you think of him or an Oliwa or a Strubko or whatever that they come over, or Evenons to come over from a background of non-fighting to all of a sudden immediately taking on the toughest guys. I mean, yeah, the fucking guts. And like you said, sure. On the job training, as you're getting punched in the face, you're learning. That's a tough way to learn, you know?
Yeah, and like for me, like I always had this kind of like a unique perspective on things because I am half Finnish and I'm, you know, half Canadian.
Yes.
And yeah, and like we talked yesterday before we decided to record the show today. I explained to you about the 1970s and the old WHA, and how some of those teams were the first ones to actually start recruiting European players. And yeah, what many people don't necessarily know back in North America is that those guys had it fucking tough when they came to the WHA. Not only did their own teammates hate their fucking guts because they thought that they were coming to steal the jobs and the women and all that stuff, but the same thing also went on the ice with the opposing team. And I have talked to enough players from that era who said that that for a very long time, when they went to the locker room, when they went to the practices, it was like, you know, 20 Canadians against one or two, European players. The hate, and they didn't invite these guys for, you know, the team festivities necessarily. And they tried to undermine these guys in every possible way in the locker room or, you know, during the practice, you know, just to make them look bad and, you know, just to make them feel fucking miserable. And this was, you know, this was the time also when not even American-born players were not, you know, that, you know, highly coveted by the, you know, Canadian players on these teams.
Yep.
So imagine being a professional athlete and going through that kind of motions, that you have 20 guys on your team who hate your fucking guts, and on the ice, there's 20 more guys who hate your fucking guts, and they're going to spear you, they're going to cross-check you, they're going to sucker punch you. Yeah, that takes a lot of guts to go, and not only to survive in such environment, but also to succeed in such an environment.
No, absolutely. And, well, like I said, we'll go back to Helenius here with his book. Like, did Sammy talk about that? Like, when he went over to St. John's and stuff, like, did he have a lot of problems with that? Or was the team fairly accepting? Or, like, does he have any stories about that?
He did mention two players' names in his book. And later on, one of these players actually joined Sammy's team in Finland. And they, you know, kind of had to, you know, make up things. So, but yeah, there was a lot of, you know, hatred and all kinds of stuff going on there. But after a while, when Sammy showed that he had the character and he will drop the gloves and he will, you know, play for the team, I think, you know, he earned the respect for, you know, from his peers on his team and also on the other teams, because there were a lot of guys that, you know, they maybe, you know, came up to the American League for one game and they were never seen again. And one of the stories I can remember was that the Western League graduate, David Chechulovsky, he came from the United League up to the American League. I think he played four games in total. And he had only one fight, and that was against Sammy. And Sammy beat him up. And on the following day, the local newspaper read, Sammy beat Chechulovsky down back to the United League. So those are the kind of actions that I'm sure, you know, made Sammy respected not only by his teammates, but also people aware that, hey, this guy means business.
No, absolutely. Well, and I mean, it was in his book. I mean, are you going to hold out on us? Who are the two names that he named in the book?
Joel Bouchard and Clark Willem.
Really? Oh, Clark, former guest of the show.
I know. And I also met him in Finland, and he was so nice. And he discussed this situation with me also. But hey, also, you have to understand that there was a lot of farm boys back in the day who went to play, let's say, in the American League, way in the East or way in the States. And those were their first encounters with Europeans.
Yep.
Also. So, and it's sometimes funny when I listen to these guys, you know, bitch and moan about soft Euros and blah, blah, blah. And then I know that these people, in fact, are only first-generation Canadians or Americans. Like, they are Germans, they are Czechs, they are Swedes, they are Italians. So they are much more European than they are North American, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
But somehow hockey has given this kind of frame for people, you know, to judge people from across the pond. Sure, there were a lot of wimps who came from Europe to different leagues in US and Canada. But I have also seen some wimpy players from US and Canada, you know, play juniors and pro.
It goes both. I saw a lot of wimpy players play for the Saskatoon Blades. Yeah, so that's certainly not just exclusive to Europe, that's for sure.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Like, for example, there's this another Finnish player that I told you about only a few days ago. He goes to play in the old SJ for the Regina Pat Blues. His name is Kimmo Lahtinen, and he goes there as a 17-year-old. In his first year, in 1978, in the SJ, in 53 games, he racks up 171 penalty minutes. Then next year, he goes to play in the dub. He plays only 24 games, but racks up 125 pens. And his final season in the dub, he plays for Spokane. In 59 games, he has 217 pens. And I can only imagine how hard it must have been for this guy. And also maybe one more well-known Finnish player also played in the SJ. And his name is Esa Tikkanen. And he also racked up, I think, more than 200 pims. Maybe you can check that out for me.
Yeah, well, it was funny when you mentioned his name. I was just like, I've never heard of this person. Yeah. I had to look that up.
You know, when we are talking about Esa Tikkanen, it's amazing. When we had that Ice Warriors tournament back in 2010, all the Canadians who were there, from Sean McMorrow to Jason Bone to Derek Parker to Curtis Swanson, they acted like little kids when they met Tikkanen because he was one of our judges there. And that tells you a lot, like what kind of respect all those players have still who played for the 80s at Edmonton Oilers. Like it was just incredible for me to see.
Yeah.
Like these guys were acting seriously like 5-year-olds around Tikkanen. It was awesome.
No, absolutely. And and like I said, going with Helenius, I mean, I noticed he had played, well, we had talked before we got going about he played on that 98 Thunder, Las Vegas Thunder team.
Oh, yeah.
Which, of course, Jolton Joe had game tapes for and made a very nice fight DVD. And yes. And what a team, man. It had Kaminsky and Louis DeBrusque and Dean Ewens. Well, of course, Dean Ewens, the hookup for Joe. And then, you know, just a bunch of tough guys. Lauren Taze was on that team briefly and blah, blah, blah.
Tripco, Helenius, all these guys, yeah.
Yeah, Chad Wagner briefly. Bob Bourne was, well, even the assistant coach was Rod Buskus. I mean, you know, even the coaching staff was tough. But
I have two great stories from Sammy's days with the Thunder. The first one actually has something to do with Dean Ewen.
Here we go.
Dean was wearing a cast on his punching hand, Jason Smear just attacked him, knowing that Dean was, you know, wearing a cast. And they had, you know, a small altercation in there. And then there was, you know, kind of a, you know, small brawl or a scrum going on. And Schmier kept fucking, you know, running his mouth from the penalty box on Dean. And then Sammy, he climbed over the plexiglass and he throws a punch at Schmier. And you can see this on those videos. But Dean loved that, you know, stunt by Sammy. He said, like, whoa, buddy, I really appreciate what you did there for me. And I was always surprised that Schmier would go after Dean in such a way, knowing that he was wearing a fucking cast.
Yeah, that's kind of obvious. Yeah, that was kind of there. Maybe there must have been maybe something else to the story there.
And there's another story. Well, Sammy was there for 2 years, but then he got traded away. And the way he learned that he got traded, oh, I love this story. He and Andrei Shripko and their Ukrainian goalie, Konstantin Simchuk, they all had a day off. So the boys decided that they go and buy a huge, large bottle of vodka. And then they decide to hit the links and go play some golf. It's a nice sunny day, and the boys are, you know, getting the bus on, you know, drinking the vodka. And then Sammy's phone rings, and his agent calls him that you've been traded. You have, you know, 1 hour to, you know, get there and blah, blah, blah. So Sammy had to leave those two Ukrainians there, you know, playing golf. And the only thing that Sammy says in his book that he was worried about, but what happened to the bottle of vodka?
Yeah. Yeah, the you said they with Strupko. Yeah, I wasn't familiar with them, until I saw the Vegas DVD back in the day, and I was just like, who is this guy? Like, he, again, big dude, and he's like putting it on guys. I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, I looked it up, and I mean, he actually came over. He played in the BC League. That's where he played junior with Langley.
Yeah.
In the BC League, and then, went to Toledo with the Storm, and then Vegas, and you know, bounced around the IHL, then Syracuse for a couple seasons. I mean, I'm sure maybe a lot of people listening aren't familiar with Andrei Skrupko, but he's a bad dude, man.
He is, and he actually also, like, he really wanted to make it there in the North American leagues, because when he came over, and I'm lucky enough to have met him a few times, with the previous time being 3 or 4 years ago when I was working for the Italians, and he was coaching Team Ukraine. And we talked about, you know, life and stuff, because we had met previously before that, like back in 2003 or something. But, you know, we talked about Sammy and that stuff. But Sripko's story is pretty damn incredible. He comes to Canada there, and then he makes the minor pro leagues, like you said there. And he still can't speak, you know, very good English. And despite the fact that he had 25 fighting majors in his first year pro, his teammates didn't invite him into any team gatherings. They just ignored him and, you know, called him all the bad, you know, all the bad words in the book. But he persisted and he prevailed. And I think his prime as a player and as a fighter was when he was in Syracuse, because at that time, Joe DeShelly was, you know, the number one guy. So Sripko only had to go like maybe 15 or 20 times a season. Like he told me that he could now be the guy who would react on the ice if something happened. Like, he could react right away. But if the play went, you know, maybe a different way, then it was, you know, time for Jody to come on the ice and, you know, settle the matter.
Yeah. No, they were quite the tag team there in Syracuse, right? And Syracuse, man, they had some tough teams over the years.
Yeah, like that 99-2000 team alone: Mike Brown, Trevor Doyle, Kavanaugh, Ferrone, and bunch of other guys who can also go, like, you know, it was, you know, a lot of those American League teams, if you look at the rosters right now, it would be so easy to point out, like, you know, 10 guys from each team who would go if needed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, like that, and it's like, and all those teams, like, it was just so deep back then. I tell you, Jay, we didn't know how good we had it back then as fans.
Oh, do you remember I sent you that one piece of commentary you had written online in 2000 or 2001, and you were already crying about how the game is so soft and blah, blah, blah. And now 20 years later, it wasn't so soft after all, you know, in 2000, 2001, but you were already crying and making yourself very audible and very well, you know, heard.
It's funny you mentioned that. I know you sent me all that stuff. I haven't read a lot of that stuff yet. One of my posts is in there. That's funny. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, that was like when I was a while back when I was doing, I can't remember what episode it was, but I was going through those aggressive hockey reports that newsletter that Sandy and them had written back in the early 90s. And in one of the, you know, air quotes, editorials, Sandy's bitching about the lack of fighting and how pussy the league is. And this is like 1993. I was like, shit, seriously? I'm like, that 1993 looks like Thunderdome compared to now. I mean, you know, I just struck me funny that anybody that could watch 90s hockey would say it was soft. I was like, I don't know what the hell he's watching, but all right. But, I mean, you could say it, look at it now and say it's soft, and I completely agree with you. As you're saying it now, they were still swinging in 2000, so I'm not really sure what I was crying about, but all right. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, and folks, for those listening, and I'll say this, I've said it before on the air, but I'll say it again, that Jay here has been an incredible resource tool in terms of getting old research for me, old newspaper articles, digging up old fried chicken articles and stuff, and fight cards and everything else. So thank you for doing that for me. It makes it makes my life a whole lot easier. It's stuff that I never would have found and looked up. But two, at the end of the day, for you guys listening, when I'm doing an interview, and sometimes you go, that's great you asked that question. That was so in-depth and stuff. Well, Jay's the reason it was in-depth, because he was the one that told me about the incident to ask the guy, because I wouldn't have known about it. So I thank you for making the interviews that much better, because they were stories that I never would have got out of the person, because I didn't even know about them. And your research was what brought me to that question. So, you certainly made the interviews a lot better, and we certainly got some good stories out of it. And I know that the guys,
it's actually great.
Well, yeah. And I know, and I mean, with the articles that you've dug up and I know you've helped out many players by sending them old newspaper articles and old pictures and stuff like that. So, Jay does this, it's the stuff behind the scenes that the folks never see that Jay does. He works in the shadows, but I know it is, from talking with the guys that I know you've helped, you know, with Parsons and guys like that, and Staniforth and shit. I know they greatly. And Frank Kovacs. I know Frank's listening. You know, and you've done a lot of help for those. You've helped a lot of those guys, and I know they really appreciate it. And
It's been a lot of fun, because, like, even though I've been lucky enough, you know, actually to make a career in pro hockey as a scout, or as the in Europe with a sports manager, which translates into, like, you know, director of hockey operations. But this is still like a hobby to me, and a lot of these guys you just mentioned, well, I had heard the name, like, you know, Kent Staniforth, and I had seen some of his fights, like, you know, years ago. But then when I hear him on your show explaining his stories, that's a whole new world to me. And, you know, also guys like, you know, Dan Kopeck, it's been great, you know, to talk to him. I sent him some DVDs, and he sent me some great photos on, you know, that he signed for me. And he sent this one beautiful photo of him and Marty the meat grinder. But also, like, it's a very tight-knit, you know, community, I think, what we have. Like, I've been making these DVDs also, and guys like Sultan, Ron, Steven, Napes, George, you, Searson, everybody has always, you know, been there for me. And, you know, you've all sent me, you know, tons of footage, and it's just great. And, you know, oh, Napes told me, by the way, that you are actually building a time machine. So how's that going right now?
Yeah, I believe me, I really wish I could. Oh, you know how many people I'd go back and yell at? I'm telling you now. Yeah. No,
well, I'm going to ask you a question. If you would have a time machine, what would be the one hockey fight event that you would go back to see in time? Mine would be the infamous myth, Gordie Howe against Lou Fontinato. And it's something I want to break down in an actual article someday. And maybe the second one will be to go back to the 1920s to see Sprague Cleghorn, however you pronounce it. And I would also love to go to the mid-90s over to Thunder Bay to see a game in the Colonial League.
No, absolutely. I have read about and heard about speaking of Thunder Bay, yeah, when Mel and them went into the crowd, I believe in Brantford, I would love to see that. That would be fun to see. Yeah. Actually, yeah, that Gordie Howe, yeah. Wouldn't it be cool to go back to Montreal for the Richard riots? That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, hey, wow.
You know?
But it's interesting, like, that fight between between Gordie and Lou. Okay, you have seen those photos of Lou's broken nose, which he had busted 5 or 6 times before he had that fight against Gordie.
Yep.
But Lou didn't miss any games. Gordie missed 2 games because of broken ribs, and he had 2 shiners. So it wasn't as one-sided as every fucking book makes it sound. And the next author to write a book who will just mention that, yeah, Gordie Howe beat Lou Fontinato and he was the heavyweight champ, I'm going to come after you.
Exactly. No, it's so funny you brought this up. Fuck, were you looking at my phone? Alec and I were talking about this exact thing last night. Anytime on these fight groups or anything else you mentioned Gordie Howe, the next post after is something about Lou Fontinato. And I said, it's become, like, on the show, we always talk about myth and reality.
Yeah.
Like, I don't doubt that Gordie won the fight. I do doubt that it was this one-sided massacre that everybody talks about.
Yeah.
Because I believe it was either you or Steve. It's probably you. But somebody had sent a bunch of, or maybe it was on Fried Chicken, I read it years ago, but I've seen it since. There were newspaper articles, obviously, about that fight. And when you read the actual articles from that exact time when it happened, like the next day, it talks about an even back and forth fight. None of them talk about this huge, oh, Gordie just destroyed him and holy fuck, we don't even know if Lou will ever play again. I mean, you talk with the way some people talk about it, you think Lou's career ended that night. Like, no, yeah. If you read these articles, it was like a very good back and forth. But over time, of course, the myth builds up and it becomes that Gordie Howe never lost a fight and destroyed everyone and all that. Meanwhile, Gordie never really fought that much. Like somebody said, he had 23 fighting majors in his career. So I don't know what all this Gordie fought all the time business is. But I think it's just one of those things that all these people over the years, I mean, at the time, they sit around cross-legged around the on the floor while Grandpappy tells them stories of Gordie. And it's just like the myth gets created and just passed down from generation to generation. And history's revisionist. And it's just, yeah. And Gordie became the conqueror of man.
The funniest thing is that what Louis Fondinato used to say, like years after the fight, that he was happy to make, you know, Gordie so famous.
Well, yeah, exactly. And for a long time, like even Lou would get like, because people, of course, later on in life would all, of course, bring the fight up all the time, right? And it's Fontinato would get, like, fucking hot about it. Like, he'd be like, well, no, he didn't destroy me. And, like for the longest time, people were saying, well, Lou was telling people that it was, like, even. And I'm like, I don't know about if it was even or not, but it's like, you know, it's, he was, fucking Fontinato would get mad about that. And it was just like, but that's like, it's like the same thing, like I always say when you bring up Scott Parker. Well, Probert knocked him out. You know, that's like, oh, okay, idiot. Like, just, Probert knocked a bunch of guys out. Probert got knocked out. So I'm like, I don't know. I always laugh when people talk about Scott Parker losing to Probert like it was a bad thing. I'm like, well, I think the entire league lost to Probert at one point. So I don't know why you keep saying that like it's some sort of knock to Scott. Like, then somehow I'm going to take Parker down a peg or two by saying he lost to Probert.
Well, yeah, and he was only 20 years old at the time.
Well, yeah, he was 20 years old. I'm like, well, he had like 200 fights after that. And look, I don't think he got dropped ever again after that. So I'm like, and he dropped a lot of tough guys. So it's like, I don't know, all of a sudden, yeah, he's 20 years old. It's like when you bring up Link Gates and they're like, oh, Koser killed him. Well, he was 21 years old. I mean, you know, and I mean, at the end of the day, Link didn't go down either, though. He stood there and kept coming, which says something about Link, too. But it's like, I don't know, people get this, or it's like this Larry Robinson destroying Dave Schultz. It's like, well, he throws three punches and pulls him down. But all of a sudden it became, well, you don't mess with Larry. And it's like, really? Like, have you watched any other Larry Robinson fights? I'm like, I'm not knocking Larry Robinson, but Larry Robinson was not that great of a fighter. Go back and watch. I mean, you know, I mean, he was okay, but it was like, you know, but you talk to these guys and it's like, oh, he, like Chara, they're the whole thing with Chara. Oh, he's a killer. Well, he is. Oh, all right. Who's he ever beat that was real heavyweight? But I mean, like I said, these myths just get built up and built up, right? It's just, it's crazy.
I'm sure someday we'll get answers straight from Mr. Chara himself after he retires, and he will be a guest on the Coliseum Chronicles.
Well, yeah, Joe will get it. Oh, yeah, but, you know, Joe can't get past the Islander jersey. He'll be sitting there pumping Chara's tires the whole time. We're not going to get a real back and forth. You know, he won't dig the dirt up and confront the Big Z on that sort of thing. Yeah, he'll just be, you remember the time when you smoked him? You know, yeah.
Darren, you're being very mean right now.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, hey, I'm a truth seeker here. I tell the truth on this show. Yeah, and we all know Joe's love of that fisherman jersey will blind him. Will blind him.
Like that fisherman jersey with the nameplate Milbury and yes. And the number one. Like, wow, that's a piece of art.
Well, and for someone that owns that, how are you going to talk sense to him? There's no talk. Exactly. They've left the ledge. You can't bring them back. Yeah.
But hey, I have to backtrack a little bit since you mentioned about Mel going into the crowd in Brantford. It was actually incredible. I was collecting these fight clips on the infamous Gary Kupel.
Yes.
And after his suspension in the OHL, he went to the Colonial League. Mm-hmm. And in this one game, he fought Mel twice.
Yep.
They had never played against each other before. But why the hell, in the first fight, Mel headbutts, you know, Kupel, and then in the second fight, he fucking knees him. Like, what was going on with Mel? Like, that surprised me.
Well, and I asked Mel about you're setting me up with a softball question because I asked Mel that very topic.
Okay.
And because I'm like, you know, Mel's usually not like that, right? He's usually pretty
true.
You know, he would get a little dirty now and again, but that was pretty wild, right? No, he had actually, I believe, he had fought Kupel before that, a couple games before that aren't on video.
Okay.
But he said he was getting mad because every time they were on the ice, he said the first time we fought, he goes, I beat him up pretty good. And he goes, and son of a bitch, he came right back and he wants to fight again. And I'm like, okay. And he bugged me and bugged me and bugged me and he wouldn't let it go. And he goes, so I'm like, you know what? I'm going to fix this fucker so he never asks me again. So he goes, that's why he headbutted the shit out of him because he's like, I'm going to make sure he never asks me to fight again. And he goes, so after I'm done headbutting the shit out of him, there he is back at it again. And I think I got him in reverse order. I think he kneed him the first time. And it was just like, he goes, I'm going to make sure he never does this again. So I'm going to give him a knee lift because he's irritating me. Because I don't think the ref saw it. And I don't think he got kicked out. Clearly he didn't get kicked out for it. But he goes, all of a sudden, Kupel's back out there again, wanting to fight. So Mel said, okay, this is it. I'm going to make sure he never asks again. And that is the fight where Mel headbutts the living shit out of him twice. Yeah. And, so that was sending a message to Gary Kupel to knock it off, and I don't want to fight you anymore. Yeah.
Hey, gee, that's even wilder than the Danbury Thrashers, whom I may have compared in my conversation with you, with this newly found fandom.
Yes.
That they are so cute and they are so harmless, bro, that Danbury Thrashers mania right now, you know, to me, it resonates with My Little Pony. It's so cute and innocent. But like you said in your brilliant solo episode, these same guys who are now, you know, praising Winger and the Thrashers, they don't even know half of the stories, what happened there, how it was actually to play against those guys. And, oh, dear Lord, if anything similar to what, you know, the Thrashers did to their opponents would happen, you know, against these guys' favorite players in the NHL now, they will probably be mighty upset.
Oh, yeah, exactly. No, like I said, I guess because it's on Netflix or something, they don't think it's real or they think it's a movie. And it's yeah. like...
And I need to say this much. When the Danbury Treasures happened, I thought it was damn incredible. It was awesome. And I still think it still is damn awesome. But somehow I feel the same way as you do with this new fandom. But hey, I'm getting old, so I have the right to be a little cranky.
Yeah, well, I think yeah, and like you said, I'm with you on that. Well, like I said, it was our conversation that obviously sparked that episode, but it was like because I had long thought that way, but no one else was kind of really saying it until you said it, and then I was like, yeah, exactly. It was yeah, I mean, I guess obviously these younger people, they weren't around when this was happening or very young, so they don't understand. So I get that part. I think the thing that, like I said, I'm happy it happened. Hell, if I was in AJ's position, I would have probably done the same thing. Yeah. You know, I dig the whole vibe of the Danbury deal and all that. But I think what irritates me with these new fans, yeah, like you said, is the hypocrisy of it. Like I said, it's all the Danbury is savage, bro. That documentary savage. And then all of a sudden, three tweets later that night, they're crying about Tom Wilson hitting their favorite yeah, player at the blue line and how it was predatorial. I'm like, if you think Tom Wilson was predatorial, but yet you're praising Brad Wingfeld. Like, did you see what he did to Josh Alzinga? Like, I mean, now Alzinga deserved, I'm not saying that he didn't deserve it and everything else, but I'm just saying, If that shit had happened in the NHL today, like, these people lose their mind over that shit, you know, yeah. And it's just like, yeah, no, I think it was the hypocrisy of it that was what bothers me the most with these fucking poser fans, right?
And I really think that your episode with Winger is one of the best ones in your whole back catalog, you know, it has to be in my top three for sure, and you know, I should maybe try to find some more time and go also listen to some of these other podcasts where Winger has been ever since they released the documentary. But I know that, you know, just the amount of facts and stories what you guys exchange in your episode, it can't be topped. And I hope it will find more audience because I'm sure Winger has so many more stories that he could share with, and he is a great storyteller. And I remember I was driving a car actually over to Sweden, and I was listening to this episode, and when Winger started to explain that little incident when he played in juniors and he was in the crowd, I had to park my car on the side of the road and replay that whole thing. Because I wanted to make sure that I grasped every aspect of it. It was so great.
You know that incident that he's talking about? There's video of that.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. No, Winger. No. Well, thank you, first of all. But yeah, no, Winger was an. Yeah, that's one of my. I mean, I've enjoyed talking to all the guys, but I will definitely say that interview was a notch above, and it certainly wasn't my doing. I mean, no, Brad was an excellent guest. Was open.
Yeah.
He was a great guest. He was open. He told great stories. He was into it, which is the funny thing about that is, and I've been told from a few people that are like no Winger personally, like they couldn't believe, because at that point he had never done a podcast before. He's not on social media. So first of all, they're like, I don't know how you got him to get on the show. They couldn't believe that I got him to do it, because apparently with like outsider, like air quotes, outsiders, fans or whatever, he doesn't talk to them like that. Like, he won't share story. Not that he's mean to people or anything like that. He's very, like, when you talk to the fans, they all liked Winger when he played there. And that's not the, but he just wouldn't, whatever you want to call it, he just wouldn't talk shop with fans, really.
Yeah.
And so they're saying, like, for him to get that type of information out of him when, like, we aren't friends or we're just, at that point, it was a complete stranger. They couldn't believe it. They didn't know how. I'm like, and I want to, and I say, I believe it was Chris Waltz that got me that interview. Was it Waltz? Might have been Chris Shaw. One of them, I had to go through a player. It was Waltz, now that I'm saying it. I had to go through a player to get it. They got a hold of Winger and blah, 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 passed on my information. And then he listened. I think Winger listened to their interview and then, you know, realized that, you know, I thankfully I wasn't just, whatever, some fucking idiot, you know, and he was like, and he felt comfortable enough that, okay, sure. And like I said, I don't know, how long is that interview? Like almost 3 hours. And I mean, he was really giving with his time. And we talked for probably 45 minutes after. No, he was awesome and really open. And I really want to get him back on the show to kind of do like a five toughest again. But like I said, just a real hard guy to get a hold of. He's real private. He's not on social media. And, but yeah, and really it's episode 3. For anybody listening that hasn't checked it out, he's awesome. And like I said, never mind that, like, he tells all the Danbury stuff too, but I mean, and again, this was before the documentary or anything, but he also, yeah, the junior story, plus he just talks about the brawl in the American League and just, you know, Western pro shit. Like he was at Quebec League and LNH and
everywhere.
Yeah, no, and he was awesome. And yeah, I can't thank Winger enough for coming on. It was a super popular episode. Yeah,
and like, you know, despite my, you know, trashers and My Little Pony comparison, which was done, you know, tongue-in-cheek, of course. But I hope that Winger will also make some well-earned extra money now, you know, thanks to this documentary and his, you know, his newfound, you know...
popularity.
Popularity. Because his story, I think, is what really carries that whole documentary. Of course, there's the family thing also there. But this whole saga against Joss Elsinga and all that stuff. I really hope that Winger, you are making a lot of extra money with this because you have earned every cent of it and even more.
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah. And like I said, he was cool. He was cool as fuck to me. He gave me a great interview when he didn't have to. I was a fucking nobody in his life. And it wasn't like I was paying these guys or anything, and he was awesome. And he got me a ton of listens. And then when it was funny, when Danbury fucking Trasher Mania hit here, I took out the Danbury portion of our interview and re-uploaded it up. And, man, it hit Chartables again, and it was in the top 50 for at least a couple weeks. Like, it was booming again. And I think it's my most downloaded episode now. But and people went back and revisited the original interview with him. So yeah, Winger was, as they say, ratings gold. And like I said, he was cool with me when he didn't, and he did the interview when he didn't have to, and I was just a fucking stranger, nobody, and he was giving with his time. And yeah, I mean, I can't thank Winger enough. And he was awesome, awesome guest.
Yeah, for sure. But
hey, I got Hockey DB open. I got more European guys to talk about here with you for a second. But
Matt Sundin.
Well, he's next. Hold on. I gotta click him away. Ivanons.
Right, it's Ivanons. Oh, that guy, the monster from Latvia. Like
that guy is huge. Holy, he's huge.
Yeah, and you know he. I think his story goes like this, that first he went to Junior A or Junior B in Ontario. And then when he was an 18 or 19 years old, he entered the United League. And that was the period of time in the UHL, which I'm sure our friend back in Iowa looks as, you know, the golden days of the United League.
Oh, absolutely.
And so for those first couple seasons, he was... there, he didn't rack up too many pins. Okay, he was a junior still, but then when he went to the East Coast League, that's when I think he had his first major, you know, pin season. And the reason why I sound here so vague is that I don't have an access to internet right now on my laptop because my laptop started to update itself to fucking Windows 11 without even asking me. So I'm going by memory here. But Ivanons really must have wanted to make the career that he did, if you consider he's a teenager and he goes to the United League. And then he probably, you know, realizes after a couple of seasons, okay, if I want to move up the ladder, I need to add something to my game, which is more likely that he can add to, like, the 50-goal scorer hands or you know, to start roughing it up. And I think the way he built his career is pretty damn amazing. and also to know that he came back from that incredible KO that Steve McIntyre laid on him. That was damn brutal.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Well, like you said, yeah, he comes over, you know, a few penalty minutes here and there, and then all of a sudden, yeah, he's in New Haven in the United League, 270 minutes, you know, then he goes to Toledo and Baton Rouge, and the next thing you know, he's in the American League, and, you know, and then Hamilton Bulldogs, 75 games, 259 minutes, and then, like I said, all of a sudden, 282 games later in the NHL with LA and Calgary, and it's... You know, and again, I think, you know, like you said, people all of a sudden this like, well, McIntyre got him. Well, you know, McIntyre got a lot of people, you know, so, I mean, they forget the 100 fights before that too, right? So, but no, for a big guy, and like I said, and like you said, for a lot of these guys, that was on-the-job training.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how big you are. I don't care how big and strong you are.
Because I remember that during one of his seasons in the United League, I know that he fought Mike Warhawk 5 times. He fought Dean Mayrand at least 2x, if not for 3 times. And that was, you know, his learning process and his learning curve, which I can compare with the one which, you know, Sami Hellenius went through. So that's a pretty tough thing to do. Like, okay, I'm going to fight Mike Warhawk 5 times. And then I'm going to fight Dean Mayrand. Then he probably fought guys like Sean Legault, who was there at the time, Jeremy Cornish for sure. And I remember in the East Coast, he fought Mitch Fritsch. So, yeah, good luck with that. Like, learning is supposed to be fun, but I'm sure that for writers even us, it wasn't always fun. But later down the road, it sure was rewarding when he made his great career in the NHL.
No, absolutely. Well, absolutely. And like we said, at the start of the episode here, you know, not only are these guys learning on the job, but there's the assimilation factor into coming to a different country, learning the language. Like, as you said, teammates that didn't like them, you know, and yeah, like I can't even imagine how tough that would be.
And you know how tough was Raitis Ivanon's first NHL fight? It was very tough because he fought your ultimate favorite, Geno Chara, and he actually lost to him.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, and like you said, just to, you know, but the fact to go through all that, like you said, play Junior A in Ontario.
Yeah.
To, you know, slugging it out through the United League and, you know, in such hockey hotbeds as like Macon and Tulsa and Baton Rouge, to all of a sudden now you're playing, you know, 70 some games 4 years in a row with the LA Kings. I mean, it's amazing.
And it'll be interesting to know how and why did he decide to go straight to the United League after 1 year in Junior A. That's pretty rare. Like, I don't think even too many Canadians have done that kind of jump.
No.
Yeah.
You know, well, and especially having no rep.
Yeah.
Like, even when you look at his Junior A stats, there's nothing there that's like stands out. Like, holy shit, we need this guy. I mean, I guess the only thing that would have stood out is how big he was. So, yeah, I mean, it's one of those, you can't teach size, as they always say. Mm-hmm. So it's like, here's this big jacked up Lithuanian guy or whatever. It's like, all right, well, we'll give him a shot. But it's like, clearly that's what got him in the door. But I mean, at some point you got to size going, you know, I mean, you need to do something at some point. You can't just, oh, he's big. Well, all right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been lots of big guys that were useless. So it's like, yeah. No, it's quite amazing.
Yeah, it is. And I know that since he retired, he's been doing a lot of great work with the junior players, and I've heard from my friends who know him that he is one, you know, one solid guy and a true gentleman too.
No, absolutely. Now it's bugging me. I had it right on the top of my head. I've had a few guys on this show that have said the same thing, that he's a good dude and whatever and all that. But that's cool that they've, well, and it's cool that I was going to say that they've come back to their native countries. And I'm glad that I don't know what am I trying to say, that they haven't had that stigma put on them.
Yeah.
That, oh, here comes the, you know, oh, this guy went to, oh, he's just a dummy. He's one of them goons that went to North America and fought. Like, I'm glad they've, like you said, Strubko's coaching in the Ukraine, and so Sammy, yeah, and Sammy's kids playing now, and he's involved, and it's good to see, yeah, that they're still involved, and they're not getting kind of like, you know, whatever, shunned for being the fighter.
Again, like, you know, ever since Craig Berube and the St. Louis Blues won the Stanley Cup, I'm so happy to, you know, to notice that there's been a lot of articles, even on the mainstream media, where, you know, these journalists have actually noticed that, right from the juniors up to the minor pro and the NHL level, there's a lot of former tough guys who are now as head coaches or assistant coaches, and they can actually do the math. They can put one and one together and understand that, hey, these guys had to always work extra. They had to pay attention. They had to find ways to improve, because they didn't have that much natural talent as some of these first liners. Plus also, these guys have to have, great communication skills, and because they were always great teammates. So they know what it means when you make a sacrifice for the team or for another person. And because they went through all that extra training, they know what works for this guy and what, works for that guy. And they have all these tools, and they can put it together, and they can teach these people, very much like, Rocky Thompson. I read a lot of the things that were published when he was applying for this NHL coaching job, and the way he prepared for those job interviews, the way he explained it, like, wow, like, he is a person I would like to talk to about hockey coaching. Of course, maybe later on, I would like to ask him about a couple of his fights. But Rocky's skills, the way he communicates, the way he thinks about the game and all that stuff, I'm happy to see that it's not only with Rocky and, Craig Berube, but it's, guys like Helenius, Ibanez, and all these other former tough guys.
No, absolutely. And it, yeah. And, and I was going to say, and to kind of go back to, for those listening, Jay's a fucking legit dude. Like, we're not just talking some dude on Facebook that likes to make DVDs. It's like, you've been involved in hockey. You had mentioned, you've been in the player's side, operations side of it. Scouted, coached, drafted, played. So, I mean, Jay is not just some fucking idiot talking here that doesn't know what he's talking about. You've been, I'm going somewhere with this. You've been involved in hockey and for years. So you're in there talking to hockey people, and you are a hockey person. So you're obviously, what you're saying is carrying weight, and you have knowledge behind what you're saying. You're not just picking this shit out of the air. And you're, like you said, you're an author. You wrote these books. You've sat down and talked with these guys. So again, I want to reiterate to the people listening, this isn't just, me and Alex sitting over here flapping our lips because we watched a couple DVDs and now we think we know everything. No, you've actually been involved. You've been in there. You've been in the dressing room. You know what's going on. So when I'm asking you these questions, this isn't just what he is guessing happened. This is what happened and what was said. So having said all that, in my long-winded how I'm going to get there, being involved in the hockey, like I said, I obviously see it from the North American side. I grew up in the North American mindset of hockey and everything else. And I know you have a very, obviously you have a, for lack of a better term, you have a North American view of hockey and want that. That's the style of hockey you like, which obviously does not translate well in some cases to Italy or Finland or wherever over in Europe. What has been, what's the overall, and I mean, the media in Canada, we have our Damien Coxes and our Campbells and everyone that would rally up against fighting too. So, I mean, we have our media guys that can't stand it. But what's the general theme over there with it? How is it viewed? And in within hockey, how is fighting viewed? I mean, I know it's a broad question because in Finland or Italy or Russia, it's all viewed different. But just in general, as you were growing up and you were involved in the game and playing, blah, 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 what was the overall view of fighting in hockey?
Well, first of all, when I was a kid, every time there was a new hockey game on the market for Nintendo or some of those, you know, early home computers, the first question everybody always asked, are there fights? How are the fights? Yeah. Nobody asked if you can actually select your, you know, power play line or your PK line. Everybody was interested, how are the fights?
Yep.
And within the hockey scene overall, I would say that majority of the people don't see anything wrong with it. But again, the way the rules are, you know, called these days.
Yep.
And the way in many European leagues, the rules have been, besides the UK and the KHL, is that if you drop the gloves, you get, you know, 5+20, and you might even get the match misconduct. So sometimes the guys, they have made the decision to fight even when it probably didn't serve the team's best interests because maybe they had a game, you know, the following day. But again, sometimes you just have to make a stand and just, you know, suffer the consequences. And I actually had a player in Finland. He was a big player and he played like a stupid fucking rat. And he would always start running his mouth after he had done something very dirty and very cheap. And the other team players were looking for, retribution. He started to get very vocal right the moment when the linesman, you know, got there in between. And one time I gave it to him in front of the whole team and I called him a fucking pretender. I'm sure it didn't elevate the atmosphere in the locker room right at that moment. But afterwards, 1 week later or so, the boys had a free weekend and they got a little drunk. Every player from the team came to me and said, it was great that you said it out loud. We hate that guy. He plays like an irresponsible idiot and he won't fight. And his bark is so big, but there's no bite. I felt embarrassed. And that was a player I hadn't signed. I have to say this much. He already had a 2-year contract going on. But, other than that, then, if you know how the media sees fighting here, in our first interview, I told you that I got actually upset one time when one of the newspapers labeled me as the high priest of hockey violence.
That's what it was.
Okay, sure. I helped a lot of tough guys with their careers. I even signed Steve McQuaid to play for my team, but eventually our head coach let him go before the regular season began. He just didn't see eye to eye with Big Mac. And, well, he went from Finland to Las Vegas Wranglers, so I don't think that Steve McQuaid minded that much.
Yeah.
But, when this magazine or this newspaper wrote that piece or, you know, published this piece saying that I'm the high priest of hockey violence, I actually felt insulted because that was the season when I traveled to scout and watch 268 hockey games, over 100 practices, and thousands of miles driven in the dark winter roads of Finland.
Yep.
And during that 8-month season, in those 268 games, I might have seen 3 fights, 4 fights only. So that got, you know, it's still something like, it's a cool nickname, but too bad that, you know, it's still, you know, fucking stamped on me. And it's been way easier for me actually to work abroad than, you know, to work in Finnish hockey, because I know that there's still a lot of people who just consider me as this one-dimensional goonie lover, which couldn't be further from the truth, but hey, at least I have a reputation.
Well, hey, it's better to be known for something than nothing at all. So, but I laughed because the first time that you and I connected was you were working with the Saskatoon Blades.
Yeah, and yeah. I was working, you know, let's put it this way, your childhood friend was my boss.
Yes, and he got a hold of me and was talking to me and said, you know this guy? And I said, yeah, well, I've heard of him. And I said, I've been on a fight message board. I think we've talked like that way. And he's like, oh, well, he's helping us scout and everything. So, and, yeah, Jared thought that was pretty funny that I knew you from a fight message board. But but he was like, well, can you kind of like talk, like, because you had asked him about, of course you did. You asked him about footage. And Jared was like, well, I know a guy that you should talk to. And then that's how you and I started talking. And so it's funny because I remember he's like, yeah, it's like our European scout, or I can't remember how he worded it, our Finnish guy or something like that. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, and then he said, I'm like, well, I only know one guy that collects fight DVDs from Finland. So I'm pretty sure I know where you're going with this.
Darren, VHS tapes at the time, not DVDs.
Oh, that's true. Right. VHS tapes. That is true. VHS tapes. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I know who it is. And then he said your name, and I started laughing. And I'm like, yeah, that's who it is. And
and the funny story how I got that gig was that after one game here in Finland, I went to see my friend Shane Toporowski.
There you go.
Who is Kerry Toporowski's little brother. Afterwards, we went to have a dinner. And then he asked me that, hey, do you think you'd mind scouting for the Saskatoon Blades because my dad is, you know, working for them and they really need a guy in Europe. And that was, I was only 25 or 26 at the time, I believe. I had been a player agent for some time before this happened. And what a huge honor, because I always, you know, ever since I was a little boy, if there was the World Championships on TV or the Olympic Games were on TV, I was always rooting for the Maple Leaf. And what an honor for me as a half Canadian to work for a Canadian major junior team, and then especially as legendary organization as the Saskatoon Blades. And I remember the first phone call from Lorne Mullican. I think I was shaking a lot because I knew about him and I knew he was the real deal. I was like, I was very green. I was very, very green. And he calls me, but he treated me as an equal. And that felt so good. Like, really, there was no attitude on his part. He didn't, you know, put himself above me. He asked me a lot about, you know, Finnish hockey and about, you know, how much, you know, the juniors practice when they are 15, 16, 17, 18, et cetera, et cetera. So that made me feel really good, you know, because I had met a lot of hockey people, you know, prior to that conversation who thought that they were, the real deal if they had worked, you know, 1 year in the Finnish league or they had played one or two games, you know, in Sweden or for the national team, like this kind of unwarranted arrogance. And that's something what I try to, you know, keep with me. If I meet, you know, young players or some young coaches, and if I feel that they are solid and that they are sincere, then of course I will, you know, try my best to open doors for them, because Shane Toporowski and his dad opened a door for me. And afterwards, thanks to this gig for the Saskatoon Blades, I got my first job in, you know, Finnish professional hockey as the sports manager. So it's a life is sometimes all about lucky breaks. And, you know, yeah, it's funny, like, to think now it's been what, this happened in 2005, and now it's, you know, 2022. Yeah. Time goes by so damn fast.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And it's funny how the hockey world, they always say, it is funny how it's a small world. And yeah, and it's, and like I said, and I know it's, I've said it on here before, and it's true, but it's amazing with the internet how it made the world so small. And it was, and you can now communicate with everyone around the world. And I've often said this with this podcast, that it can be heard around the world. And it is heard around the world. So I see the demographic, not that there's a million people listening, but it's, I've always said, it's really weird for me to be sitting there thinking that I was in my back room of my condo yelling into a microphone about something and some guy in Russia is listening, or in, or Finland or whatever. And it was just, you know, and it's pretty wild. And the same thing, right? You get on the message boards, you start talking to people. Next thing you know, you're trading VHS tapes or DVDs with a guy in Zoltan in Russia, or with you, or with that, you know. And it's just like, I go back to, like, you know, whatever, when I'm in high school and we're doing the hockey goon draft in the basement, and, you know, we're buying fight tapes or fight VHS tapes out of the back of the Hockey News, that here I would be, you know, 30 years later talking on a microphone to a guy in Finland about, you know, Christoph Oliwa or something. You know, it's pretty fucking wild.
Yeah. And I actually, now I need to backtrack just a little bit when you asked me, like, what the people over here think about fighting. Well, last year, I met some of my friends who are coaching in the Finnish professional leagues here. And what do I give to my friends? I give my friends hockey fight DVDs.
Of course.
Because they love to watch this stuff that I have, because a lot of these DVDs that I have, you won't find this footage on YouTube. And they like to watch these fights also sometimes with the players. And I know, hearing this from two of my colleagues, they say that, oh, I hope some of my players would have even one tenth of the spark what those guys used to have when they had, you know, the old AHL or IHL, because they are still hoping that it will be just a little bit more like, what's the word I'm looking for? A combative sport, that there will be just a little bit more grit out there. You know, even these coaches, they feel this way, and they are, you know, between my age and your age, which, you know, translates to 40 to 45, right?
Yeah. No, exactly. Well, and it's, yeah. And everyone you talk to involved in hockey, everybody I've had on the show that I've talked to hockey, that is involved in hockey, says the same thing. They wish it was go back to the way it was, or there was just maybe not so much go back. Well, some guys do, but maybe not go back to whatever, 1998 Syracuse. But I mean, have a bit of it. Have, like I said, have something. Have some jam, have some grit. Somebody, well, like I said, goddamn, someone get mad at somebody. Really? Can someone get mad about something? Like, everything's just got to be sportsmanship and buddy-buddy. I said, shit, they even fight, they're not mad. They're bro-hugging after. It's like, can anybody just be an asshole? Please, somebody be an asshole. That's why, like, everybody kind of, like I always said, to go on some rant here, but, like, with Reeves. Well, yeah, I'm like, yeah, Reeves is a prick. And I love the fact that he is. And I said, hell, there's fight fans that get mad at him about it. It's like, really? Like, why does everything have to be this good job, bro? I don't get it. Like, why can't people just be pricks? I mean, I'm not saying you got to run them over in the parking lot when the game's over, but I mean, during the game, why am I being nice? What is this nice shit? I don't understand it. But it's just this mindset of today's game. It's just, it's literally getting ingrained in sports. Everybody be nice to everybody.
Let's say that I would have a hockey team right now, and we will play, say, against the Minnesota Wild, or we will play against the Maple Leafs. And if I could choose my opening forward line, I would have a Kevin Kaminsky, Andy Biiso, and Kevin Evans.
All these guys
were under 5'11", I'd say. Yeah. But with that intensity, with that fearlessness, with that grit, and with that will to go over the edge, oh, I would love to see the consequences of that first shift that these guys will play. We will have the edge, and we will have the momentum for the rest of the game. because these modernist players, they have never had to play hockey when they have been actually under fear or intimidated by anyone. They have never experienced that. Everything's been so nice and smooth ever since they joined the hockey school.
Yep. No, yeah, people can laugh and whatever all they want. If you can still intimidate people, and intimidation works. And if you play fit well, there's been a guy that's been picked up at the trade deadline, what, 3 straight years now, that has won 3 straight cups, named Pat Maroon.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, in 1990, and I'm not knocking, I like Pat Maroon, but in 1998, Pat Maroon's about the 7th guy on the team in terms of toughness. But nowadays, he's like the ringleader, but I mean, on his team. But I mean, yeah. What he brings that intensity and that, and like you said, guys feed off that energy when they're hitting, when guys get, I mean, everybody else becomes 3 inches taller when Maroon's out there. And it's not that Pat Maroon's Tony Twist, but I mean, he brings that attitude. Same thing with Reeves. Like, why do you think all these teams pick him up? Why do you think the Rangers went and got Reeves? It was for a reason. And all, shockingly, who's in first place right now? Oh, gee. Here they went from getting fucking absolutely abused and embarrassed by Tom Wilson to the following year, they go and get the toughest guy in the league, and look who's in first place. Oh, well, gee, shocking. You know, and it's just like, but these idiots just can't wrap their head around it. Now, I'm not saying the New York Rangers is going to win the Stanley Cup, but don't tell me Ryan Reeves didn't bring something to that team. Of course he did.
No.
But they can't. You know, they just think he's some sort of goon and useless. Like, no. Well, people in hockey don't think that.
He's another guy who made the wise decision, perhaps, you know, that he was more of a player, but then he decided to take a more specified role. And it's worked pretty well for him. And also, let's say that his timing was perfect, the way this part of the game has slowly been dying out. But it's actually interesting that he is also one of those guys, like, you know, Riley Cote was back in the day.
Yep.
That they decided, okay, I'll add something extra to my skill set. And it's not going to be the soft hands of a 50-goal scorer. So, good for these guys.
Exactly. No, it's like Paul Bissonnette. There's another guy. Everybody's old Biz and Spit and Chiglets and old Biz is the big goon and blah, blah, blah. No, he wasn't. Guy was an OHL All-Star. Guy's an East Coast Hockey League All-Star. But he made the decision in his mind. And, you know, I mean, he was always a gritty guy. It wasn't like he was Lady Bing candidate in junior or anything. I mean, he played with a grit and would fight now and again. But he made the decision. He looked at Pittsburgh's roster, realized they didn't have anybody that would do it. And he decided, I'll be that guy. Which, again, takes incredible balls that I think people don't realize. Same, and like you said, same thing with Riley Cote. And with Reeves. It was funny when Reeves started making noise in the East Coast League and in the American League. You know, I had a couple people, oh, you should see this Reeves guy. And I'm like, oh, yeah. And they're like, yeah, he's an old dub boy. I'm like, who?
Yeah.
I didn't know he played in the WHL. I didn't know he played for Brandon. I'm like, who is this fucking guy? Because you go and look it up. I think he had 3 fights in Brandon the 1 year and 5 the next. Yeah. Like, I think he only had about 10 WHL fights. And it was just, but he was just a big guy that was physical, but he wouldn't really fight. But then he was smart enough to realize that, okay, if I'm going to make, I don't have the skills to make the NHL, like offensively, but if I start hitting, I'm going to use my size, start hitting guys and start fighting. And well, now look, I mean, I don't know how many NHL games he's played, probably 500 or 600 at this point. And I mean, he's made millions of dollars and I know he's got it. Well, and you know, you've made it when you got your own beer. He's got his own beer in Las Vegas. So there you go.
A craft brewery
in Las Vegas. Well, craft, I mean, unfortunately, it's craft beer. I know Jay in Iowa there, he'd be all over that and his chestnut ale or whatever it is. But, I mean, this year, if we go back to Vegas, I will, for the podcast and for the science experiment, I will buy Ryan Reeves craft beer. I believe it's called Revo 75. And I will pick it up and report my findings back. But so I'm like, yeah, you've made it when you got your own beer. But no, but Ryan Reeves is like, yeah, I always say with fight fans, I've never, for supposed fight fans, they hate fighting. I mean, you read these message boards and all they do is shit on Reeves and all these guys. I'm like, well, shouldn't you shit on the 650 guys that don't go into a corner? No, you you shit on the 6.5 guys that do. You know, I'm like, I don't understand it. I don't know where Reeves gets all this shit from, but whatever. You know, yeah. But, I threw out his name earlier, and I forgot to bring it up when we were talking about Skrupko and all the, Oliwa was a name that I wanted to bring up.
Yeah.
Have you had any interactions with Oliwa?
Never. But I saw him play one game live, and of course, you know, probably seen pretty much all the footage that there is on his career. But, you know, another guy coming from a totally different kind of hockey culture,
yeah,
over to North America and just being like a huge guy, 6'5 or whatever, and just learning to the role. And there was a year maybe of, I'm not sure when it was, but the early 2000s, he played one World Championship tournament for Team Poland. And let's just say that he was exposed out on that large Olympic ice sheet. Like he was slow. He didn't have great hands, but the amount of fear and respect that he commanded out there, it was exactly the same thing what I saw when Jody Shelley played in Finland during the 2004-2005 lockout. I went to see one of the games and to meet Jody, but it was so funny when his team was on power play and the coach, and he sent that Jody out there and he went to screen the goalie. And the defenseman of this other team didn't even touch him with the stick or anything, because at that point, all these Finnish players thought like, well, he's a goon, and if I touch him, he's just going to snap and he's going to beat me up. It was hilarious to watch. Like, there was so much open free space for Jody in front of the net on PP, and same thing with Oliva. And like, I would say maybe Oliva isn't my favorite fighter, but you have to respect the amount of hard work he had to do, because even by the 1990 standards, when he made it to the NHL, he wasn't one of the most skilled enforcers out there. So he had to fight, and he had to fight a lot. I think that one year, including preseason and playoffs, he had 45, 46, 47 fights. And the year after, he also had over 30 fights. So he worked hard for sure, and probably wasn't much fun for him either, you know, to go overseas and learn to this kind of new role.
No, yeah, like you said, he was, he actually did it, especially in New Jersey. Like, yeah, like you said, those late 90s years in New Jersey, he was pretty solid. Like, he started really figuring out in Albany. You know, those first couple of years, he was a big guy, and he kind of, you know, did a lot of wrestling and, you know, took some thumpings. But I mean,
yeah.
Those last couple of years in Albany, you know, putting up the 200 minutes and whatever, and the 300, and then all of a sudden to go to New Jersey, was, he had a pretty solid run and had some really good, he had some big wins over guys.
And, yeah, and I think when he came to North America, he also began his career, and I think he began his career in there in Junior B level. And then the season after that, he went to Raleigh in the East Coast, and then he got called up to Albany.
Well, let's have a look here.
Like, if you make it to the ECHL from Junior B.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, that's incredible. Oh, like, let's say that you play Junior B for 1 year as a European, and you learn to the role, and the next year you go to the ECHL and the American League. Oh, good fucking luck, buddy.
Well, yeah, like you said, like, yeah, like, yeah, is this really correct? Yeah. Yeah, in 92, 93, he was playing for the Welland Cougars.
Yeah, that's Junior B.
Yeah. And then the next year, he plays 33 games in the American Hockey League with Albany and 15 in Raleigh and in the playoffs in the East Coast League.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, to go from, you know, well, and before that, comes over from Poland And then, like you said, can't speak the English. I can't even speak the English. He can't speak English. Or anything, but he's just, something with these, it must be in the water over there, these massive dudes. I mean, Oliwa was huge. So, I mean, obviously that helped him too, but it was like, fighting isn't even, you know, I'm sure it wasn't like he was doing lots of fighting and bowling. So it was like, come over and you play, and next thing you know, you're in the American Hockey League in Albany. Like, are you shitting me? Like you said, it's just the journey. It's just fascinating, and I had never thought about it. Like I said, right at the start of the show, talking to you about it the other day, I had never really, like I said, it's I'm just viewing it from North American eyes. I never actually put myself in the position of a guy coming over, having not really having that mindset, but coming over and wanting to make it so bad that he's willing to do anything. And he just, like, I'm just going to start, especially back then. And to start, I mean, at any time, but especially you're in the 90s with all these killers all around you. And it's like, I'm just going to start fighting now. It's like, really?
And,
like,
you know, it's very similar. Like, for example, I read the Val James book.
Yes.
And, not only the racism he had to, you know, face there, you know, from the fans and from the other team. But in that book, there were also stories about how things were sometimes within his own locker room.
Yeah.
So it's been so hard, you know, for so many just to be able to play the sport that they love. And sometimes the reason you have been hated is the color of your skin, or then that you were born across the Atlantic Ocean. So for me to, you know, to think about these guys, you know, they made it through despite, like, that they would have, you know, 20 guys in their own locker room just hating their guts. You know, how tough, like, let's say that next Monday when you go to work, how cool, you know, would it be to you to know that everybody whom you work with, they fucking hate your guts and they think that you are scum.
Yeah, they're trying to actively get you to lose your job.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah.
Like, I have this great story about one of the first Finnish players ever who went to play in the WHA. And this guy later on, actually, I worked together with him in Finland. He was coaching the team and I was signing the players. But he goes to the WHA training camp and he meets this tough guy from Ontario called Keith Kokkola. And any Finn would instantly, you know, recognize that this guy has Finnish heritage because his last name, Kokkola, is also a city in Finland. So Keith Kokkola comes over and, you know, makes up a nice conversation asking about Finland, the Finnish food, the culture, the weather, the summer cottages, the saunas, or saunas, like you say. And he also explained his family story, you know, to this Finnish player. And of course, this Finnish guy being first time over in the U.S., being maybe a little naive because not too many Europeans had yet played in North America. So he thought, yeah, nice, I made a friend. And then they go on the ice, and Keith Kokkola just attacks this guy, a cross check all over this guy's face, and he loses four teeth. And Keith Kokkola yells at him, "Keep your head up, you fucking Finnish chicken shit." So that's one way to learn that.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, no, exactly. And it's just like shit like that. Like, it's one thing when you're playing and, oh, the other team hates you. Yeah, oh yeah, whatever. But yeah, when you're hated in your own locker room, holy shit. Like, yeah, that's a whole level of and like you said, and it's not like you've done anything to warrant this hate. I mean, there's guys that, like, are just fucking clowns and no one likes them. Well, that's their own doing because they're just idiots. But no, this is just from the fact that I'm from Poland. If you don't like me, you know, and it's, and just like, it's pretty.
And when you consider, you know, when the WHA came around, just prior to that, the NHL had its first expansion.
Yep.
And then WHA comes around. So there were a lot of guys making it to the big time who really had no serious business, you know, being up at that level. And yeah, maybe some of these, you know, Europeans from Finland and Sweden and even Germany, maybe they were just, you know, better suited to play on the first line than these guys who were playing in the old Eastern League on the third line, maybe scoring 20 points and, you know, racking up, you know, 150 pins. Because at the end of the day, every team wants to win and they need to win. So it, but hey, again, like these stories are brutal, but also I think they are very entertaining. You know, for example, this story that I just shared with you, not all the stories that we've, you know, discussed, you know, before recording, but yeah, the world has changed so much in such short time. And now we are complaining that everything is too nice and, you know, too comfy. I wonder how it's going to be when we are 60, 70, or 80 years old.
Yeah, well, like you said, right? It always seems with whenever in anything in life, it seems when there's changes being made, everything's to the extreme, right? Like, yeah. There's a lot of things that should have been changed from back in the day. But yeah. We maybe could have leaned a little. You didn't have to completely dump the scale over. I mean, like I said, it seems to be, anything in life is extreme this nowadays, one way or the other. And it's like there's never any, the happy medium doesn't seem to exist anymore in a lot of things. So unfortunately, if we could have found the happy medium, I think we'd be laughing. But man, I mean, we've been an hour and a half. We've kind of yapped away about lots of different things. The last thing I want to talk to you about before I let you go, I know it's getting late there. You were talking about DVD. I mean, you've put together a ton of DVDs lately. The biggest one being the Serge Roberge one that was that turned out excellent. But I still talk about the Mike Bro thing for a sec. How many fights is that now?
Well, according to my latest research, I was lucky enough to discover some old websites using the Wayback Machine. And on the old Drop Your Gloves website, they listed Mike Brawl as having 619 fights. Then I did my own little research because I'm working on his DVD collection as well. I still need to locate around 80 of his tilts. And then I can consider the collection, you know, to be as complete as possible, you know, to the best of my knowledge. But now I found some lost stats, some lost fight cards. And about 1 year ago, I did my previous research and I came up with, I believe it was 723 fights for Mike Brawl in his career. And now I still need to go through all these box scores and whatnot. But Mike Brawl had closer to 900 career fights than 800 career fights. That's insane.
Well, that's, yeah.
And I would like to say, because I've watched, or now I've seen approximately 400 of his fights, none of these fights have had anything to do with, you know, protecting his teammates.
it wasn't after a big hit, a big clean hit.
No, it was.
What do they call them? Premeditated? Or is that what you're saying? Yeah. Are you saying there were a lot of Mike's fights are staged?
Oh, I would never say that about any fights from the QSPHL or the LNAH. No.
Could you? I can't even wrap your head around that. I just had to bring that up. 900 fights. I laugh because here's Jay. He's telling me in private messages. Oh, I found he had 600 fights. Now it's 700. And then 800. Oh, now we're closer to 900. And then, so do you have any of these DVDs? I'm like, this is a project that's never going to end.
Oh, I know. But again, like, you know, working on that Serge Roberge collection for well over a year, you know, trying to do the best possible research to place each fight in a chronological order, and, you know, trying to ID some of the fights that, you know, the footage was like very crappy quality. I'm sure there's still some mistakes, you know, Zoltan, he already sent me an email about a few mistakes. But the funniest thing is that I also decided to make this DVD available on YouTube. And after like 2 or 3 days, they were all taken down. But these DVDs are free to download. And you don't have to pay any money for these, because I don't need any loonies, because I don't need to go play any fucking pinball. If you catch my drift, bro.
I do.
Oh, cool.
There's a few folks out there that'll know what you're talking about. Pinball Wizard. Hey, yeah, put your loony down.
Before I choose to go, I'll have to give a couple honorable mentions here on these European tough guys. One is still playing in the NHL, the flying Frenchman, Antoine Roussel. He is maybe more of an agitator, but during his North American career from the Quebec Junior League through ECHL, AHL, and the NHL, he has racked up 134 fights. So that's pretty respectable. Yeah. And, you know, coming from a French guy who's only 5'11", so, you know, hats off to him. Like, that's a huge accomplishment. And then back in the day in the OHL, there was a lot of hype on this guy, Boris Valabik. And he also played a few games in the NHL. But I don't think he ever became that tough as all the fans were expecting him to be. But still, like, he played a very, very solid career. And I remember the old OHL Tough Guys website. They always, you know, talked about his fights. And then, of course, your former guest and my friend Roman Volpat. I would really like to also complete my Roman Volpat DVD. I made one about 15 years ago for him, and I hope I can again find his contact information. But he's probably the most honest person I've ever met in hockey. Like, he's just a great guy, and, you know, no nonsense. And also for him to go to the Western League without, you know, having any English skills, and then learning how to play in the North American way, having some of the fights that he did, and then, you know, being a part of that famous, you know, Gretzky trade, or, you know, getting traded, what it was, you know, 3 times in 2 weeks. Like, he had it tough. He had it really fucking tough.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of respect to Roman. Like, he's a very good man. And there's still 3 more on honorable mentions here. Fredrik Oduya, the late great Swede.
Yep.
He was so damn tough, and he was such a nice person. He took some time off from hockey after, I believe, 99-2000 season. He had a lot of injuries, and I think his back was operated, and he went back to school in Stockholm. Then he wanted to make a comeback to pro hockey after like 5 years. And I was there to help him, let's say that way. And one day his fiance sent me an email about his tragic death driving the motorcycle. So yeah, that was really tough. Like, he was such a sweetheart, I have to say. Like, such a kind man. Freddy Oduya. Tough as hell.
Yep.
And also, I never asked him, but when he went to the OHL, not only as a Swede, but also as a person with African heritage, I'm sure he had some kind of run-ins there with, you know, racism and stuff like that. But he was tough, and he had such big heart. It's incredible. The first ever European to lead a major junior hockey league in penalty minutes was in 2008, Josef Sladok from Slovakia. He played for the Plymouth Whalers in the OHL. And some years later, he came to Finland. My friend was coaching a team, and they needed a tough D. So he comes to Finland, and just like a few weeks, you know, prior to his arrival, he had his first professional boxing match. So that was an instant scandal over here. But Slats is such a great guy, and he's just slowly coming back from a bad injury, and he's playing in Slovakia, and I'm sure the UK fans remember him well. And I know that Slats will someday probably give you or Alec an interview when he's retired from the sport, but I know he has a lot of great stories to tell. And this is not an honorable mention. This is one of the toughest Europeans of all time. I'll give you a hint. In his NHL debut game, he had three fights. He fought Josh Gradden twice, and then he fought against, I believe it was Sean O'Donnell. Do you know whom I'm talking about here?
No.
David Gotchi.
Oh, okay. Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why. No. I don't know why my mind went to like Nazarov. I'm like, who? I'm like, oh, yeah. Gotchi. Yeah.
And there's a reason why Nazarov is not, or why he wasn't on my honorable mention list. But
I don't know if I use the word honor, but okay.
Yeah. So he fights Gratton, and Gratz TKOs Gotchi, and Gotchi goes to the penalty box feeling all bad about himself. He's afraid that he made himself look really bad, and I am, you know, quoting this from an old interview that he gave to the Czech media some years ago. So he decides that if he gets another shift, he will go back at it and, you know, try to challenge, you know, Gratz again. And this time he gets the win over Gratz. And then his third fight was actually against Nick Boynton, not against Sean O'Donnell. But that's a pretty impressive NHL debut. Three fights, and I believe it was 41 or 44 penalty minutes.
Yep. Well, and like you said, that guy, he fought everybody. And I mean, yeah. I know he fought McGrattan a million times in the American League. And,
yeah.
You know, like you said, win some, lose some. Probably took a few. But yeah, guy had guts, man.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and it's funny, I mentioned Nazarov there earlier. I mean, what a character that guy is. I mean, I'll tell you, I've never seen anybody like he was a first round pick by San Jose, yeah. I believe. Big dude. I remember watching fight tape, and I mean, again, when you go back to the minors and whatever, there was, you know, with Engels that we talked about, Mel, and
all
the craziness that happened in the minors. I had never seen a guy in the NHL in that time frame in the 90s. I'm not talking the 70s with Durbano and all that, but in the 90s, just openly as dirty fighter as Nazarov was.
True. Yeah, there was no code, you know.
No, there isn't. But all of a sudden, just like headbutt, eye gouge, hair pull, and like national televised games, the refs are all standing there watching. It wasn't like he tried to hide this shit. It wasn't like it was in some dingy rink in Des Moines in the United League or something. No, this is hockey night in Canada. We're in Winnipeg, and he decides he's going to start unloading headbutts on someone. It's just like, what the fuck? Like,
but mainly, I would like to say that the reason why Nazarov was not on my list at all is more because of his actions and his comments since he retired and when he became a coach, because the stuff that he has encouraged his players to do, the stuff he has said, it's just like, I have zero respect, just no respect at all. And I have to respect that he made it to the NHL as an enforcer, not maybe the most entertaining fighter or the most winningest fighter, even though your favorite Bob Probert fanboys are probably crying over the fact that Nazarov probably beat Proby, even though he might have jumped him a little bit. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Well, I mean, like you said, well, we won't go too much into it, but like I haven't followed any of that. I know he's coaching over in the KHL, but like what is he like, just talking stupid? Like what? Like, I don't understand. Like when you said his comments, like what, just gooning it up or what?
Let's say, Darren, that we can discuss those matters off air.
Oh, all right. We're going to do that. Okay.
And also to all the Bob Probert fanboys whose feelings I just hurt, do not be afraid. I'm actually a fan of Proby as well, and I have a Bob Probert tattoo on my left arm. So yep. Shut up.
No, don't start talking common sense here, Jay. We can't do that. But, well, there we go. Well, like I always tell you, this certainly won't be the last time I have you on the show. I always enjoy having you on. And like I said, I think today's episode is really cool just because it's certainly, I think it's a different perspective from, well, majority of my listeners will have. Because I'm sure they're coming from how I looked at things or my mindset around the game. So to have you on and explain your side, you know, coming from the other side of the ocean is always a good thing. And I think it's great to see, hear both sides of the story and your involvement to get those stories. But no, man, it's
been
cool.
And I'm sure that the Darren who wrote that great piece 20 years ago, back in 2001, he would not probably wanted to have this kind of a conversation with a half European guy.
Well, yeah, well, that's exactly right. I mean, see, this is the thing, right? As we get older, you gotta hang out with different people. You learn things, right? And you open your mind. So there we go.
Hey, for me too, like same thing. I have been there in Saskatchewan, you know, living my life there in Regina, and I can tell you honestly, after living in, is it 6 or 7 different countries by now, Saskatchewan is one of the most unique places I've ever been to, because that prairie lifestyle is its own world, totally. Like, I've never experienced anything quite like it, and I never will, and I hope someday the world opens again and I can come there for holidays, you know, maybe meet up with you and Dan Kopeck and, you know, Kent Staniford and yeah.
Absolutely. No. Yeah. Mm. Well, you know, at some point here, I know it's sometimes it's dark clouds and we can't see the light in the tunnel, but things will open up at some point. And we'll get you back here in Saskatchewan. And absolutely. I'm going to make you come to Saskatoon. I ain't driving to that goddamn Regina, that hellhole. I'm not going there, but you could, you show up here and, we'll get some Great West in you and, we'll get you rolling. It'll be all good.
That sounds very good. And thanks for having me on. And I'm hoping that next time, if I come on, then, you will be speaking Finnish with me, because I'm embarrassed again to notice how rusty my English has, you know, or how bad my English is right now. But hey, there's also a reason for this, because the world is closed. I don't get to travel. I don't get to speak the languages. And I think my German is actually now better than my English. And that you know, that tells you something. And the funniest thing is that I learned German when I was living in Italy. So I will leave you North Americans wonder about that for a while.
I was going to say, yeah, okay. Well, no, your English was very good. Oh, hell, shit, anybody that listens to friggin' Part-Time Oli, shit, he butchers the language worse than you do. So, no,
Mr. Conan Salen, and I think because you always say Part-Time Oli, and he talks about the code, so why don't we just call him Cody?
Well, there we go, Cody. I like Conan Salen. I like that one.
Well, that's good too.
I'm hitting him with that as soon as we hang out.
And hey, with now that he's so popular and he's so well known at the Florida Everblades games.
Yeah.
I believe that Mrs. Olin Salen has to learn some boxing or something, because Alec is gonna, Mr. Conan Salen, he's gonna start to attract some puck bunnies soon.
Oh, the groupies will be, yeah. Exactly.
Oh yeah, big time. Yeah. They're all going to want to share or, you know, to taste his bush apple.
Yeah, exactly. Split your bush apple with me. to be young again, Jay, and have these problems.
Oh, I agree. Because when we were his age, hockey was still a lot of fun to watch.
Like I said, I don't know how they do it these days. But, well, sir, right. I want to thank you very much again for coming on the show. Like I said, this certainly will not be the last time you're on. It's unfortunate just the time difference. Like I said, with 8-hour time difference, I just had the day off, so it worked out. But one of these days, you might have to stay up late one night. But I think we'll have to get a group chat with Coden Salen and maybe Lazito or something, and we'll
I was actually going to propose you that because I want to challenge you here so that you actually will have some future content on your show. So you will have me and Steven on, okay, on air at the same time, and we will discuss the early NHL and NHA tough guys of the 1910s, 20s, 30s, maybe 40s.
Well, and that's true. And for you folks that don't know, yeah, Steve, when Provert was king.com, and Jay here started doing some really in-depth diving into the early parts of fighting in hockey. And we're talking like Sprague Cleghorn and Blackjack Stewart and Eddie Shore and all these guys. And no, I think that would be awesome to go back, kind of do a history of fighting kind of around. And I'm just going to hit record and slowly back my chair out and listen, because I have no idea about any of this stuff. I mean, I've heard the names, but I mean, you guys have, you know, gone back and like, you were posting like the Montreal Gazette from like 1920 with these like fight articles and stuff. So
yeah.
And I mean, I know Steve's into that too. So, no, I think that, I think that'd be outstanding to go back and to really, like I said, you have to, for these people, you gotta learn where you come from, right? You gotta learn this history if you're into the hobby, and you know, it all started, you gotta respect the era before. So I think to go back and to go over all that stuff, I think would be really cool. So that's a good idea. I think that definitely we need that to happen.
And something what I told Napes just the other day was that, you know, maybe 20 years down the road, there won't be any new fans who will know about guys like, you know, Mel Engelstad or, you know, Gary Kupel or David Kochi or any of these guys. And I think, you know, to be, you know, frank, when we are gone, nobody's going to know about these guys anymore.
No. No, and that's the thing. And that's why, like, with the podcast and stuff, and I've said this before, like, when I had my old .com site, when it went down, one of my main things when I joined the network, when Isha got a hold of me to join the network, is I told him flat out, I will do it, but I am bringing back my old episodes and re-uploading them, because I want those to be out on the internet for people to listen to. And once it's on the internet, if it's saved and everything else, it's there for a lifetime, right? And it's like, and I want those in, and I mean, it sounds whatever, but I mean, I want someone to be able to go back and listen to Brad Wingfeld's interview, or Josh Mazur, Chris Graff, and Kopech, and all these guys. I want that to be out there. So, because they're all, it will be, well, and through the younger generation, it's no fault of their own, but they weren't around when it was happening. So, and that's also the really cool thing with YouTube, is that, but I mean, you need people to upload those fights. That's the thing. I think sometimes these younger people or whatever, when they watch YouTube, they just, the shit just fell out of the sky and it was magically there. Well, no, someone had to take the time out to upload this stuff. So, and I think that's very important too. And, that which really bothers me when YouTube starts erasing shit, because you are in fact erasing history. Hockey fight. And now again, it's hockey fight in the grand scheme of things. Is it the, well, no, it's not, but you know what I mean? For the sake of us talking here and our fight fans listening, that is fight history that should not be erased, and people should take the time out to at least recognize it.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, you mentioned Dan Kopech there again, and, you know, Josh Mazur, and, you know, Chris Waltze, and, you know, Ken Staniford, and like, yeah, I get my share of hockey here in Europe. I follow certain leagues, you know, just to stay on the radar, you know, for the future. But if I get to choose, like, what I do during my spare time, I have zero reason, you know, to put on an NHL game of, you know, 2022. I'd rather watch the Kent Staniforts, Dan Kopechs, Chris Waltz's, and, you know, Josh Mazur's fights all night long. And especially when I know their stories, you know, thanks to your show, like, it's so awesome that you and Alec and Joe are doing what you're doing, and you know, providing us with some great content. And thank you again for all your hard work.
Well, I greatly appreciate that. Thank you. You read that just like I wrote it. And that's outstanding. But look at that. Hey, we're closing it right.
Hey, people, remember to download this episode if you won't download this episode, I'll hunt you down.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Download it. Don't stream it, you bastards. I need to get paid. And I gotta pay Jay's gas money when he gets here, so I need the money.
Yeah, and you know, you people from Alberta and Saskatchewan, make sure you go to Lloydminster Fountain Tire and go say hi to Mr. Kent Staniford.
That is true. And I will tell you, if you need, especially in this weather, you need winter tires. You hit that fountain tire in Lloydminster. Yeah. Tell them the Fourth Line Voice sent you. You'll get a deal. I don't know what kind of deal. He might charge you more. I don't know. But no. But even I said, just go check out his office. You're going to see the cool shit he's got in his office. And like I said, he'll probably give you a Toporowski story.
Yeah. And actually, I know what Mr. Staniford has on his fridge door. Do you know what he has on his fridge door?
No.
He has a postcard from Finland.
Well, there you go.
I wonder how that happened. He's also getting soft as he's getting older.
Oh, he's slumming, I'll tell you. Yeah. Well, there we go, man. Like I said, we're closing in on the two-hour mark. This has been tremendous. I think the people that regularly listen to the show will just be excited that there's actually a different voice than mine on here. They're getting sick of me. But I want to, again, thank you very much for coming on. It won't be the last. And, man. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Darren. I'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely, man.
And you people that don't like fighting, how many of you did you walk out and get a coffee while that was on?